All right, thanks for coming, everybody. I think we're going to get started. So thanks for attending session 167. This is titled The Kingdom Embraces All. Just at the beginning, we just ask that everybody silence their cell phones for the presentation. And also just ask that everyone here today engage thoughtfully and respectfully, understanding that we all come from varying backgrounds and beliefs. Now, the kingdom concept in Mormon theology has narrowed over the 170 years since pioneer settlement in Utah. The law book used by the first government in Utah, the laws of the state of Deseret, consisted of the Ten Commandments alone. The Decalogue was understood to be a constitutional law document that embraced the hopes and aspirations of every portion of that early society. Today, the church tends to view the kingdom as the membership of the church. Modern scholarship demonstrates that ancient Israel understood the Decalogue the way early Utahns did. Our presenter today is Robert Kimball Shinkowski, is a graduate of Stanford University, also a 30-year employee of the Utah Department of Health, and the author of several books, which I'm sure you'll talk about a bit today, on biblical and U.S. history. He'll probably take about 45 minutes of this hour, and then at the end we'll have about 15 minutes for a Q&A, roughly, and so we'll just go from there. So I'll go ahead and turn the time over to Robert. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for sharing the podium with me here and for expressing a little interest in what I'm doing here today. And thank you all for coming. It's great to have you here. I was telling Ryan I'm having a difficult time making the transition into presenter. I was listening intently to three or four presentations this morning, had a great time, took notes, was inspired, and now I've got to get inspired about my own presentation. It seems kind of tawdry compared to the Iranian woman who talked about being a youngster during the time of the Iranian Revolution and the women downstairs who are involved in getting an action ready for September, November, or October conference coming up for ordained women, and just a lot of things that are happening that are very interesting, challenging intellectually, and I've really enjoyed it. What I want to do at the very start of this presentation is to kind of tell you the end, the punchline, kind of the right here at the beginning. The conference theme is around Matthew 25, and please come on in, sit down, and enjoy yourself. I was made aware just the last couple of weeks that there is not only at this symposium, but across the country, a kind of a Matthew 25 movement. A movement, I guess, that was sort of born from worries that Americans have about how the marginalized are going to be treated under the new presidential administration. So I'll just get that right out there. But the Matthew 25 is a portion of scripture that really should be motivating Christians at all periods of time, because we're talking about something that is so authentically associated with the mission and gospel of Jesus Christ, and that is to really welcome, commune with, sit down and eat with, embrace those who are marginalized, poor, needy, underprivileged, whatever vocabulary we'd like to have. In fact, Jesus, in this parable of the judgment of the nations, which is in Matthew 25, talks about the ill-clad, the hungry, the thirsty, those who are in prison. And so a group of people that were singled out at that period of time for being those who were really kind of left behind. So, but my thesis for this presentation today is that although that is it's important for us individually in our church congregations, in our neighborhoods, at work, wherever we go, to individually engage and serve and lift up members of these marginalized groups, that may not be enough. And the reason I say that it may not be enough is that anciently the Israelite people, who organized themselves into a democratic republic, something that's being more and more recognized today in scholarship on the Old Testament, those people used as their constitutional law document the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments taught the people and structured a government around democracy. And in fact, in that ancient society, that government and those people acting individually and through their government were able to do remarkable things in terms of lifting the poor, the widows, the orphans, as the Bible often suggests, did a remarkable job. But when they neglected that foundational law, which taught them how to do democracy, when they neglected how to be good citizens and participate in their government, then the marginalized groups were really slipped even further in stature in society. So my thesis today is that in this democratic republic, under our constitutional law, we need to renew democracy and participate in government if we hope to effectively move people in a Matthew 25 direction. So let me get started with a little story about something that happened to me. I don't know. I'm roughly pegged about 35 years ago. I was a young student down at Brigham Young University, and I was walking through the J. Reuben Clark Law Library. I had time on my hands, which I haven't had since. But I had time to kind of go down the stacks and look at the pretty books. I was looking at the pretty books and the title of some of the law books, and one book grabbed my attention. It was the tiniest volume in the stacks in the library. In fact, it was about half the size of this paperback book. And it was bound in black and had a very rough, heavy cover, and it was teensy. It only had a few pages in the book. So I pulled that book off the shelf, and the title of the book was Laws of the State of Deseret. And I knew enough about church history to know that there was a period of time in which the Latter-day Saints actually were a country unto themselves. They actually were not affiliated with the United States as a territory or as a state. And so they had to have some laws. So it was interesting to me, as I opened this book up, that there was a set of 10 laws that guided behavior in 1852 in the state of Deseret, in this intermountain region here. And that was the 10 Commandments. I just thought that was amazing. How could a set of laws that were kind of dealt with church attendance, you know, keep the Sabbath day holy, that kind of dealt with worshiping God, and dealt with, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't commit adultery. How could those kinds of laws be something sophisticated enough that an entire small nation could base their behavior on? So it was very interesting to me. I put it back on the shelf. I thought about making a copy. I never did. I never returned to those stacks to find the book again. But maybe 20 years later, I knew somebody who was a general authority who was a lawyer, and so I let this man know that this book existed, because I thought, what if nobody knows that book is there? It could be of interest. It could be of interest to people. So one of the things that little experience reminded me of was something in the Old Testament that, if you have read the Old Testament, you might have heard this story. It was a story near the end of the southern kingdom of Israel. The northern kingdom had been conquered by the Assyrians in 700 BC. The southern kingdom was happy, prosperous, doing well. Things were going well. All was well in Zion. The 99% of the people thought that things were going to continue to be well, but there was a little bit of concern about the Babylonians. So the previous kings of Israel made an alliance with the king of Babylon. They felt very secure. It was a military protection alliance. They're going to be defended. It required the king to defend Israel. But interestingly, about that time, the high priest of ancient Israel, Hilkiah, discovered a book in the archives of the temple. And this book created a great furor. this book contained the Ten Commandments. Not that the people didn't have the Ten Commandments currently. There was an Exodus version of the Ten Commandments. But what this version of the Ten Commandments that was found in the temple contained that was different was a whole bunch of commentary made by Moses himself. Moses gave a farewell address to all of the people of Israel before they crossed Jordan to settle Canaan. And it was a marvelous, inspirational kind of speech. And what Moses did is he filled in what we might call today the legislative intent of the Ten Commandments. He explained what they really meant. Everybody knew what they said. It was written right here in Old Hebrew. We knew what that document said. But what do those laws mean? What are you looking for, Ryan? Am I good? Okay. So Hilkiah found this book. He read it. He was astonished. He sent a courier with this book over to the young King Josiah. Young King Josiah was the grandson of the worst king ever in Israel. The worst king ever in Israel was Manasseh. He had an extremely long reign, and the Bible says he hurt many people. But here's a good King Josiah who reads this book, which contains the Ten Commandments and commentary about it, filled with information, by the way, how to do Matthew 25 in a society. Filled with that information. Josiah rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and prayed and said, let's take this book over to the prophet in Israel at that time. Now, interestingly, the prophet in Israel was a prophetess. Huldah was her name. She was the go-to prophet in Israel. She was the one who, when we needed a word from God, Huldah would be the one who would get that word from God. So this book went over to Huldah. She read it, and she made a public pronouncement. She said, I have a word for Israel. I'm going to speak for God now. She said, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I will bring evil upon this place. And then she said some more things. Basically, what she said was, we have slipped so far away from the Ten Commandment constitution of this nation that our laws are hardly recognizable with respect to this Ten Commandment constitution. So what happened was, these were the three great powers that be in ancient Israel: the high priest, the king, and the prophet. These three were of one mind that there needed to be some major reforms, and so what came about were the reforms of Josiah. And this was a Ten Commandment renewal movement. It was a Matthew 25 renewal movement. It was not a movement that was strictly based on individuals helping out needy individuals in society. It was a movement based on getting government back into the business of really recognizing all people in Israel and working to empower the voices of all people. And just a little sidelight, because I'm interested in the Old Testament, perhaps you are too, there is a shadowy figure in this section of 2 Kings. There is, of course, Hilkiah the high priest. There's the king, the young king Josiah. There's the prophetess Huldah. But there is also the individual who is writing 2 Kings. Scholars today believe that one single individual, a historian that lived about the time of the destruction of the southern kingdom, this individual wrote the story of the rediscovery of the Ten Commandments, wrote that story, kind of chronicled it, but also wrote the 600-year history before that time, starting from the time of Moses when he made his farewell address, and then said, I'm retiring into the mountains, and Joshua then crossed Jordan. From that time forward, this is a section of the Bible known as the Deuteronomistic history. It's a group of seven books beginning with the book of Deuteronomy, which most scholars believe is that very book that Hilkiah discovered in the temple that day, 600 years after it was first written out by a scribe. This book was rediscovered. Now, when there was a press run in ancient Israel, this was handwritten by scribes, and the press run was probably a few copies, or maybe a dozen or two. And after 600 years, this book had been lost. Perhaps the people had heard about Moses's farewell address, you know, something like in our country today, George Washington's farewell address. We still have that farewell address, and in it are some golden nuggets about what our Constitution really means. So this prophet, scholars believe, edited the book of Deuteronomy, Moses' farewell speech, and then wrote the book of Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. So all of the history, basically, of Israel came from the pen of one individual. And the reason why they think it came from the pen of one individual, there is, in literary studies, there is something called a literary fingerprint. Somebody writes with a particular style, uses particular idioms and expressions, uses a particular format, and all of these books have that characteristics of one single writer. And interestingly, that same literary fingerprint is found in the book of Jeremiah. So many scholars do believe that Jeremiah, who lived at the time of the destruction of Israel, was the one who said, boy, things are getting bad. I think this country's going down. I'd better write our history before the books are destroyed and we don't have the source matter material to really tell this story. So this heroic figure, Jeremiah, doesn't write himself into the story at all. He's writing about Huldah the prophetess, the young king, Hilkiah, who were all so bold as to say, boy, we have really slipped in what we can do as a nation for the poor and the marginalized of our people. So that's just a little. It's speculation, but it really is pretty solid speculation that Jeremiah put together this history. Now, let me just say that what I want to do today is introduce you to a new interpretation of the Ten Commandments. I think it's possible to know today that we have been wrong about the content, the meaning of the Ten Commandments. There's no question that we know what the Ten Commandments say, that we have capable translations from the old Hebrew into modern English or King James English 400, 500 years ago. But we have so many hundreds, even thousands of books written about the Ten Commandments over the last virtually 1,000, 2,000 years. So many books written about these 17 verses of Scripture that it kind of begs the question that we are not too comfortable that we really know the meaning of the Ten Commandments. If we really felt that we knew exactly what was going on in this ancient text, we would say, somebody, some authority, write the book, and we'll all know what it means. But we have hundreds of books coming out. Everybody who's a theologian, anybody who's a pastor or a priest or a rabbi or a mullah feels like they've got to tackle the Ten Commandments and tell everybody what it means. And what they think it means has been pretty uniform for a long, long period of time. And I think now biblical scholarship has progressed to the point that we can understand that we've been wrong. We have viewed the Ten Commandments as religious laws or ethical imperatives or moral commandments that are binding on all people and could perhaps even be binding in law. But in fact, I think there's enough evidence to show now that these are laws which dealt with and had as their object the organization of government and the behavior of government officials, primarily. They applied to all citizens, but they really wanted to deal with how Israelite government should be fashioned. The story kind of leads us in this direction. Israelites left Israel. They left behind them the law of Pharaoh. They were in a state of nature for a period of time, a few weeks, a few months probably. They camped at Mount Sinai. You remember the story about the wild partying and all the craziness and taking their earrings off and building a molten calf. They were really free to do whatever they wanted, and they were experimenting with some stuff. Moses went up on the mountain, came down after consulting with God and negotiating this set of 10 articles of whatever. I'm going to say they're 10 articles of government. Came down, obtained the consent of the people to these laws, and as soon as they ratified these laws, these principles of organizing government, they began to make laws. They actually assembled a legislature and started making policy for the nation. So the Ten Commandments, somewhere, one of those Ten Commandments was an article that set up a legislature to make laws. So, but let's take the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." That seems pretty straightforward. It's always been inspiring to me. As I read dozens of books about the Ten Commandments, I went back to the Reformation and read Martin Luther and John Calvin on this, and went back to the early Catholic fathers on the Ten Commandments. Everybody felt that the first commandment meant put God at the center of your life. How could that be wrong? That's absolutely, everybody believes, what that law means. Have no other gods before me. The problem is, I think that is wrong. I don't think that is what that first commandment actually means. And to demonstrate the difficulty of correctly interpreting an ancient text, let me give an example from our own English language, how a particular idiom in the English language has fallen into obscurity. We don't know what it means anymore, and it's just 100 years old. My father, when I was a young boy, used to say to me, as if he figured I would understand, he said, "Kim, don't look a gift horse in the mouth." And my dad, I think, understood what that meant. I had no idea what that meant. He would look at me, say that, and turn around and walk away feeling satisfied that he had taught me something. I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. My dad and his father and his grandfather grew up in a rural area in the cowboy West in a horse economy. I was a young urban cowboy who grew up in an automobile economy, and I didn't know anything about horses. So within 100, 150 years, an idiom that everybody in the West understood, "don't look a gift horse in the mouth," had fallen into total disarray, at least in my mind. I had no idea what that meant. Now imagine a idiom, a phrase, an expression, an aphorism that is 3,000 years old, in a different place, a different continent, a different time, a different worldview, a different set of politics, a different set of technology, different science, and an entirely different culture. They had expressions that were absolutely understood by everybody in that culture. One of those expressions was, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Another one of those expressions was, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." We think we know what that means today, too. We think we know that means don't cuss or swear using the name of God, and don't treat God and the church lightly or blasphemously. So, but it turns out that those are two idioms that I think we understand with our mindset of today, but the mindset of ancient Israelites was very, very different. Here's one of the idioms that was common in the days of the Old Testament. And if you think you know what it is, please let me know, because I don't know what this means. this King Josiah that I was mentioning, once he read the book of the law, which was discovered in the temple, he said, we have to stop giving horses to the sun. Do you understand what that means? That's really, that's an idiom that probably was understood. I can imagine a conversation in ancient Israel like this. Did you hear about King Josiah? He said, we've got to stop giving horses to the sun. And the neighbor would say, oh yeah, I saw one of my neighbors gave a horse to the sun just the other day. I can't believe what our society has come to. It's just, can you even believe that? So, you know, this was something that was understandable to people, but completely incomprehensible to us today. So I want to just give you a little introduction to what I think the first commandment is all about. I think if we understand the first commandment, we can understand all 10. And I think these 10 commandments speak like thunder to us today out of the dust from 3,000 years ago. Because I think the 10 commandments teach us how to do democracy. And we have forgotten how to do democracy. And we've forgotten how to enfranchise the voices of the poor. Now, my first clue as to what the Ten Commandments were actually about was the Exodus story. And I just want to rehearse it very quickly for you. You know the story. 12 tribes of Israelites descended into Egypt because of a famine. They found themselves in Egypt. They liked where they were at. They stayed for 400 years. Near the end of that 400-year period, there came into power a dynasty of pharaohs who were very mean-spirited and very powerful. It's called the House of Seti, or the House of Seth. There were several rulers named Seth and several rulers named Ramses. Most scholars believe it was Ramses II who was the pharaoh of the Exodus. You know the story of Moses. He was one of those Hebrews stuck in Egypt in a very bad period of time. He grew up in a privileged position at court, but as a young man, he killed an Egyptian and fled the country because he did not trust that he would get a fair trial in Egypt, because the Hebrew minority were a political liability to Pharaoh. They're growing powerful in numbers, and they believed their ancestral traditions were sort of democratic, and democracy was not something that was popular with Pharaoh Ramses II. So long story short, Moses led Israel, the 12 tribes, out of Egypt. They camped at the base of Mount Sinai. Moses went up, negotiated the Ten Commandments, came down, they were ratified, and the people began to make laws. But an interesting thing about the First Commandment, everybody seemed to understand the First Commandment in that date and that place. They understood that this had something to do with getting government started in Israel. But the first commandment was not given for at Mount Sinai for the first time when 600,000 Israelites camped there at the bottom. The first commandment was given to Moses many years before when, as a young man, he went to Mount Sinai. He approached what he thought was a burning bush, and he heard the voice of God. God said, I have heard the cries of your people. I want you to go to Egypt and help them, relieve them of their oppression. And Moses was reluctant. He said, I'm not the guy for the job. I'm not a leader. I'm not a speaker. I don't think I can do this. God talked him into the task. Moses said, but the way God talked him into the task was to say, I will go with you. My presence will go with you. I'll be at your side. And Moses says, okay. And then God gave the first commandment for the first time. He said to Moses, go and gather the elders of Israel together. So what God did here, the first commandment to Moses then became the first commandment given to all of Israel, and that was to set up a legislative body that would deliberate what it is that bothered you as a people and then decide what you want to do about it. He said, empower yourselves, elect representatives from all the 12 tribes, get together, sit down, and send then Moses as your ambassador to Pharaoh to negotiate what can be done. So in essence, God said, if you want to be free, start acting like you're free right now. Get together, elect people, act like you care, bring some propositions to Pharaoh. And that's what the Israelites did. So God, at the time of his first meeting with Moses, actually gave Moses the means to liberate the people from Egypt. Moses took that to heart. He did what God suggested. He organized the elders together. In one passage of the Bible, he actually took the elders with him to see Pharaoh. In other passages, he goes alone. So the first proposition that the elders bring to Pharaoh was, we would like to go into the desert for 3 days and worship the God of our ancestors, because Moses has reminded them about this God, and this is very inspiring to us. We want to go commune with this God, and we want to have religious freedom. Pharaoh said, no, this is not going to happen. So the Israelites came back with another proposal, which was, we would like to leave Egypt and return to our ancestral home. Many people, I can imagine, in the camp of Israel debated this issue. He won't even let us go for a holiday away from our brick making for 3 days to worship God and then come back. He won't even let us do that. How is he going to let us leave? And others in the camp of Israel, others of the elders, I can imagine, were saying, look at this. Pharaoh hates our presence here. Our democratic tendencies infect the entire Egyptian population with ideas that Pharaoh does not want them to have. So he may well be willing to let us go. So you know the story, after 10 plagues and a lot of negotiating and back and forth, the elders, together with Moses and the people, 600,000 people, the Bible says, left Egypt. So, for me, this understanding of the first commandment kind of goes like this. Have no other gods before me. The key and operative word there in helping us decipher the first commandment is me. Who is this God? If we are to have no other gods before this God, who is this one? So this one is self-described in the prologue to the Ten Commandments. This God says in that prologue, I am the Lord thy God who led you out of the house of bondage in Egypt. That's how I'm defined. That's who I am. That's what I do. Don't have any other God in your society but one who frees people from bondage and oppression. Have a free society. Make sure that you always have a free society. And the way that you have a free society is you empower the voice of the people through a legislature of representative leaders of each of the 12 tribes. Seems awfully mundane, awfully simple, isn't it? Yet that's what our democracy in the United States is all about. The very first commandment in our constitutional law is an article of government that empowers a national legislature and makes that the supreme lawmaking body of the land. The president isn't to make laws. The Supreme Court is not to make laws. It is the legislature. And we've slipped a long ways from that. We now have our presidents making laws by executive order, just in the same way that kings in ancient Israel began to take over the lawmaking function from the legislature. This is a key slippage in our country and in ancient Israel. As long as the legislature the true voice of the people is supreme and is making the laws, including declaring whether we go to war and deciding how we make peace. And until and unless we are doing that, we are not a free people, and we are not enfranchising even the male white voices in our society, let alone all of the other voices that we want to enfranchise. So the Ten Commandments, the first commandment in particular, teaches us a great deal about our own government today. The first commandment is paramount because it establishes the legislature. So the first book I wrote on this topic about 10 years ago was a book on the first commandment. And in addition to empowering a legislature, the first commandment, I believe, establishes religious freedom in ancient Israel. So I wrote a book entitled, Do My Prophets No Harm? This is a little idiom that came out of the Psalms, and to me it suggested very strongly that God wants religious freedom so prophets and prophetesses can do their thing, so they can rise up out of the dust and remind us about some important things, which if they don't have the freedom to do so, we will not have those reminders and we will not be led in a good direction. So I wrote a book about how, and the subtitle of that book was Revelation and Religious Liberty in the Bible. The first commandment not only authorized the legislature, which enfranchised all the voices of the people, but also protected their religious and political freedoms. So I believe that's what the first commandment does. The next book I wrote on this topic was a book called Biblical Captivity, which I interpreted the second commandment. The second commandment, you know, is no graven images. Well, what does that mean? Some people have gone so far and off base as to suggest that that means no artwork in Israel. And many of the rabbis of ancient Israel kind of thought that was the way it was to be. We didn't want to make any depictions of nature or people or whatever because somehow that was against God's law. But in fact, if we continue this political analysis of the Ten Commandments, we come to understand that the Second Commandment actually refers to the image of a ruler, of a king, that gets stamped on coins, it gets cast into images and made into statues to glorify a single individual as a ruler of a nation. Israelites understood that that's exactly the way government was in Egypt. They wanted a law that would make that impossible to happen in Israel once they got to Canaan. So they made a law that said no graven images and no graven images and no molten calves. Silver molten calf or bull was the usual symbol of monarchy in the ancient world. And the Israelites flirted with the golden calf in the very beginning. Moses came down and reasoned with Aaron, deflected that whole movement, and negotiated democracy instead of monarchy. So the whole idea of no graven images was a political statement about kingship. There was to be democracy. That was guaranteed by the first commandment, but in order to bolster that, there was to be no kingship. There was to be limited chief executive. So for the first 200 years in Israel, there were judges. They were not called kings because they didn't have any power. They didn't even have a permanent position. Only when they needed to have a judicial decision about a case, or only when the Midianites or the Philistines were attacking their communities, did they even call, that is to say, elect a judge. So the president of ancient Israel was called a judge, and he didn't have much power at all, and that's the way the Ten Commandments wanted it. That's the way God gave it to Moses. You can't sustain a democracy if your chief executive runs wild by making his or her own wars and by making policies that bind say in our day, 320 million people, and this is one individual making the law. That's not democracy. It wasn't democracy in Moses' day. It's not democracy in our day. So that's the second commandment, and that the second little book I wrote on this topic was called Biblical Captivity, Aggression and Oppression in the Ancient World, because that's exactly what happened when you got a strong-armed king. He began to oppress his own people and act aggressively to neighbors, conquering foreign nations, bringing in loot and tribute from foreign nations to enrich his coffers. The Israelite Republic was dead set against it. Our constitutional republic was dead set against that. And that, along with the second commandment, was the fifth commandment, which is a strange little law that we've misinterpreted for a long time. That honor thy father and thy mother. Well, everybody knows what that means. It just means our parents do so much for us that we really ought to respect them and occasionally obey them, do what they ask of us. Well, that's not what that law means at all. It is a companion to the second commandment. It is an article of government which enfranchises local government in Israel. Local government is in the hands of mothers and fathers. They have a large household which includes a lot of children. It includes relatives, older relatives, cousins. It includes household servants, field workers. It includes shepherds, it includes wayfarers, travelers who are boarding at the house. In the ancient Israelite nuclear family, it wasn't very nuclear, it was very large. It constituted almost a little city, a little town. So that law, the fifth commandment, gave power, law enforcement power, policy-making power to mothers and fathers to decide things, particularly for kids, but for everybody who lived on the family estate. This kind of understanding of the fifth commandment is pretty well established in scholarship these days, and I think it's wonderful because we have the same concept in these United States of America. If you look at family law for the colonial period and for the first couple hundred years of our, well, that would be our whole national period, you see that parents have legal authority to decide what is going to happen with their kids, where they go to church, where they go to school, what they learn, what they believe, what clothes they wear. We are the lawmakers in our children's lives, and a lot of that has eroded, but we had in this country, parents had the same power over their children's lives. They had the power of local government. So that's the fifth commandment. So now, how much time have I taken so far? When did we start, Ryan? 15
more minutes.
15, so I've been going a half hour?
45.
Perfect. I'm ready for questions. Boy, I couldn't have timed that better. So what do you think? This is crazy, isn't it? And the other seven commandments, I've mentioned the first, the second, and the fifth, I think have to do with organizing government and parceling out the duties of government in a national government. It has nothing to do with how we should worship God or how we should not have artwork in our society. We shouldn't have, or how, you know, we should just be kind to our parents. It all has to do with structuring democracy in an ancient society, and it used very curious language to do that. So, question, yeah. Yeah.
Is there actual biblical evidence that we should read that?
Yeah, the question is really a good one. Do we find that language anyplace else? And I have not found it in any extra biblical literature. This is an interpretation that, but the entire structure of how government is done and how democracy is done and how molten idols are symbols of kingship. All of that is very well established in extra-biblical literature. It's just that the words, thou shalt have no other gods before me, is very is kind of unique, but actually I think there's some hints about how it may have been much broader. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not commit adultery. How in the world does that apply to government? We know, thou shalt not steal. Okay, don't tax the people too much. Don't take away their property. Don't condemn their property by eminent domain. Take away their land. Don't do that. Don't kill. Don't kill your own people. That was a common thing that kings did. Remember, the Pharaoh of the Exodus wanted to kill all the firstborn of Hebrews. Oh, yeah, and he had the power to do that. So the Israelites said, we're not going to do that in this country. We're not going to give government the power to kill its own people. But how about not commit adultery? This was the hardest of the Ten Commandments for me to decode, because I couldn't see anything related to adultery except for the fact that kings had a lot of wives. Comment?
Maybe they made some sort of secret treaty with Russia and affected the future leadership.
Well, you know, this is funny and very cute, but that actually is what the seventh commandment is about. The idea of going, as the Old Testament says, going after other gods, going whoring after other gods, means making alliances with the gods that represent other countries. And that's how you commit adultery. You are to be faithful to the God of Israel. You are in a faithful relationship. You are like what does the Bible say? The groom or the bride? I forget. Let's call God the groom and Israel the bride. You have to have a faithful... The Israel is the groom, because Israel goes whoring after other gods, looking for women in other countries. So actually, that is the way Jeremiah writes about the seventh commandment. He talks about how Israel is committing adultery against its God by making alliances with other countries. And the great irony of this is that Jeremiah's exposition of the seventh commandment and the tenth commandment was exactly right. That's exactly what happened. Israel made a military alliance with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and 99% of people in society, including all of the court prophets, were saying, we're good. We got no worries. We'll have peace for generations to come because Nebuchadnezzar is on our side. Jeremiah, being a good student of history, said, this is what our Constitution says we must not do. We must rely on our God, our people, our own resources, but not the armies and not the protection of other nations. So we are going to suffer. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come into our land. And the people didn't believe Jeremiah and wrote him off as a minor nuisance in society until Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, took Israel captive in Babylon, and then I imagine a conversation like this took place. This is by the river Chebar in Babylon. Some elders of Israel are saying, wow. Do you remember that guy who said this was going to happen? What was his name? And the other guy says, Jeremiah. Yeah, I remember Jeremiah. Well, what happened to him? Oh, I know what happened to Jeremiah. He fled Palestine before Nebuchadnezzar arrived. He went to Egypt. I think he's there. Well, did he write anything? Yeah, he wrote something. He wrote a history of the nation of Israel. A 7-volume history. He did? Well, maybe we better contact him and grab this history. And he also wrote a volume of his own prophecies too, the book of Jeremiah. So I can imagine, because that Jeremiah was rediscovered as a figure of major importance in Israel after the Babylonian captivity, because he had correctly prophesied exactly what would happen when the politicians... The conventional wisdom of the day was that we can make alliances with other nations and not suffer. So what I learned about the seventh commandment was that that was a law stating we should not commit adultery against God. Israel is married to God. God is our king. God gives us a law, which is how to do democracy, that is what, that is our king or our surrogate king. We have no monarch. We have a weak chief executive who keeps his nose out of the policymaking function of government. He does what the legislature tells him to do. And I'm sorry that was such a long, I hogged the rest of the time almost here giving you that answer, but is there any another question maybe? You've all been very patient. Thank you very much for coming.